Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
And welcome to our annual Oscar show, our Oscar version of The Nose. This is Colin McEnroe, and the only reason I'm saying, telling you what my name is because I haven't sat in the studio for about more than 2 weeks now. I've been out getting a knee replacement. So I'm very excited to be back today and to have with me in the studio the queen of the Oscar show every year, Vivian Nebeta, director of marketing at the Hartford, at the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center, James Hanley, co-founder at Cine Studio at Trinity College, Rand Richards Cooper, a contributing editor at Commonweal and writes the In Our Midst column for Hartford Magazine, Rebecca Castellani, the director of venue operations and tour marketing for We Save Music. So it feels as though, to me, it could be just me, because I'm also, I have to confess, I've always hated hosts who haven't seen the movies, not just on Oscar shows, but sometimes you're just listening even to a public radio show and there's some filmmaker on or something. And, you know, the host was just too busy to see the movie. And I was thinking, well, that sucks to see the movie. It's like, anyway, that I'm that guy this year. Because of the knee surgery, I just didn't get to see anywhere near as many movies as usual. So So feel free to patronize me, I guess is what I'm saying. Vivian, I could be just me for the foregoing reasons, but I feel as though, you know, every year it's a little harder to get excited about the Oscars anyway. And then this year, maybe because all the misfires with who's going to host it and stuff like that, I don't know, there seems to be especially a kind of malaise over the Oscars.
Oh, yes, there is a special malaise. I think that obviously we know about what happened with Kevin Hart, and he was hosting and then it wasn't hosting. And now we're like, who is hosting? It looks like nobody's hosting. You know, if your knee's feeling better, maybe you're hosting. Right. And I do think that overall people are a little less excited about award shows just in general. I think, you know, regardless of what kind of award it is. I do know that I'm looking forward to seeing certain people dressed really pretty, Danai Gurira, on the Oscar show. But yeah, I mean, I think people are kind of over award, so just a little bit.
So, and I know, James, you, as usual, have a dark transgressive theory about, in this case, the inability of this particular award show to sustain itself as a television show. Can it still be a good television show?
Well, I think to me that's really the most basic problem about it. I think that in the past it didn't have so much competition amongst award shows, number one. But I think there's also there's always been a sort of dramatic tension between its status as an entertainment and also its insider status for the people who are actually artists and the people who do particularly the technical work, who people I really sympathize with, actually, because I think very few people realize how much goes into actually creating some of these extraordinary productions. And we just had this ridiculous suggestion come by that, oh, we'll run some of those technical awards while the commercials are going because nobody cares. And that sort of seemed like a slap in the face of some of the people who really deserved the attention and who don't get it. And so then I'm sure that the pressure there is there to create this entertaining event kind of thing. And it's those elements of entertaining event that have actually sort of crashed and burned this year with a lot of misfires and people not really being sure. But that said, I think there's actually a slate of some very interesting films behind it all. And so I certainly see it as being something interesting to watch. The question is, you know, unless it somehow turns around and gets some gigantic audience, most people are going to see it as, well, you know, is this really, can this really continue?
Is anybody aware of the Whiskey Cavalier conspiracy theory? I'm looking at you. It seemed like something. All right. I'll come to it in just a second. Let me just pause that for a second. So, Rand, I think you and I are on the same page about this, too. Like, what I don't particularly enjoy is sententious, self-congratulatory speeches, people thanking everybody they've ever met in their lives, people doing a lot of virtue signaling. And it seems like there's going to be an awful lot of that this year. And the only thing that can ever counteract that, I think, is a host, and a host who is Puck or who is the fool. And I'll sort of let you take it from there. But one thing that we look forward to every year is some host making a fairly cruel Mel Gibson joke or something.
Right. I mean, I'll just confess up front that I rarely watch the Oscars. I try hard to watch all the movies. But to me, focusing on the Oscar ceremony, it's a little bit like thinking about a restaurant and paying all the attention to the service when really we know the main thing about a restaurant is the food. That's what we care about. But I do think the host, the times I have watched, with the self-deprecatory humor is sort of a saving grace of the program. I do think, you know, the Oscars in terms of audience for the ceremonies peaked about 20 years ago at about 60 million. I think it was the year Titanic. People consume, obviously, their media differently. It's not clear that people are still going to be willing and able to sit down for 3.5 hours and consume the show the way one used to many decades ago. So the suggestions for getting rid of what James referred to as the technical side, which is cinematography and editing, these are basic categories of filmmaking. They were going to do those during the commercial. The thing is, everyone's aware that, oh, it's 3 hours, 3.5. It's like baseball. You know, you're going to have at the Oscars a sort of clock that's going to determine the maximum amount of time you can take to bumble your way through. But I don't watch them mostly because in some weird way, I don't want certain illusions that I have about the performers in the movies to be, compromised. And you value a certain performer for the way he or she performs in a film. And then to see, somewhat shockingly, the disappointing mere mortal up there sort of bumbling her or his way through a banal and often self-aggrandizing acceptance speech, it's like, no, I don't want to know this person. I don't want to look behind the curtain. I just want my brilliant performer. And I think that's one reason for me that I don't watch.
Well, I mean, Rebecca, if they're not going to be funny, and I feel without a host, they're probably not going to be particularly funny. I mean, we can look forward to Tina Fey or Amy Poehler coming out there as a presenter and maybe being funny. The other thing they can do to be exciting is talk about some of the so-called elephants in the room. So, and I know one of the ones that you've been following. I mean, first of all, we know they're going to make a lot of speeches about empowerment and about more equal opportunity for black performers and filmmakers and for women performers and filmmakers. We know that's all coming, and it's fine. But I mean, there's only so much of that you can listen to. But I suppose you could listen to somebody talking about the Bohemian Rhapsody Bryan Singer problem, which I will let you take over.
Yeah, I think at this point, the only thing that's going to redeem this is if they exercise some real self-awareness and we get these elephant in the rooms addressed. I mean, this Bryan Singer controversy associated with Bohemian Rhapsody has really kind of been something that Rami Malek hasn't addressed and just recently started talking about. And I think that if he does win, which is looking quite likely he will, I think that that's really the only redeeming thing that can happen at this point for that scandal is that he really addresses it out in the open and, you know, it says this is absolutely an unacceptable problem that has been continuing in every aspect of Hollywood from the beginning. So I do think that's the only way this is going to be at all redeemed. However, I think if everybody's getting up there and kind of opining the state of the world, it's going to get quite tedious.
Let's, as long as we're talking about Bohemian Rhapsody, which I assume most people know is kind of a Queen biopic, let's hear Gwilym Lee as Brian May, the aforementioned Rami Malek as Freddie Mercury, and Ben Hardy as Roger Taylor.
Our lead singer just quit. Well, then you'll need someone new.
Any ideas?
What about me?
Not with those teeth, mate.
I know what I'm doing. I got a feeling I should be doing all right. Doing all right. I was born with four additional incisors.
Most face in my mouth means more range. I'll consider your offer.
I guess the question that I would have, though, I mean, Rebecca, it seems unlikely. Let's say Malik did win for Best Actor. Is he going to take that moment when he's up there to say...
Probably not, but yeah, this whole movie has been embroiled in this controversy, yeah. And it has been embroiled in controversy before this. I mean, they had a different actor attached to the lead role, and that didn't work out, and there's been controversy with Brian May, who's wanted it to be. He initially wanted the movie to be the first half about Freddie Mercury and the second half about Queen post-Freddie Mercury. So I think that to not address what has come before in the creation of this final product, which is, you know, a wonderful performance by Malik, but other than that, it's sort of an underwhelming movie, I think would probably be a mistake.
So I have to, because I'm the person who has to tell this, by the way, what I'm about to tell you will completely feed into James's view of this. So there's been quite a bit of dispute about the fact that, A, these very important awards were going to be given out during a commercial break. And then also there was a plan for a while that only two of the five nominated songs would be performed. I think now we're up to four. The only one that's not going to be performed is that is the thing we opened the show with from Black Panther. And I think that's because there's technical problems involving Kendrick Lamar and SZA and them being able to do it. And they just couldn't make it happen and they didn't want anybody else to do it. But anyway, they were going to get it down to two songs. And one of the theories for this, James, you'll enjoy this, is that ABC has a, you know, kind of Rock'em Sock'em spy show they're debuting called Whiskey Cavalier. And in very much the manner of the Super Bowl, at the end of the Super Bowl, the network that has the telecast usually throws some kind of product that they're trying to hype on for the next hour. And the idea is that ABC really wants to or wanted to get this new show, Whiskey Cavalier, on at like 11 o'clock. So to do that, they had to get even more ruthless than usual about the length of all this. But that kind of goes to your theory, too. Like, what is this? Is it a television show? Who is ultimately being served here? And ABC, I think, thought, well, I think maybe we should be served.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And I think that's a direct result of the diminished audience that any time a show of any kind that has less audience or needs to work harder, then there's a vulnerability there. And as far as ABC is concerned, I can see that, you know, they have these sliding scales for advertising. And if this show starts at 11 o'clock, then they're going to get X amount of dollars. But if the Academy Awards drags on till midnight, they're going to get much less. They're going to get less exposure. And I think that a lot of people don't realize the nature of the decisions that get made by, you know, a bunch of lawyers in the background kind of thing. And I think that that happens with like the whole affair around Netflix and Roma, you know, who was, you know, what power they had in the industry when they didn't even want to show in theaters. All of these conflicts sort of become more significant when the audience isn't like this massive, huge force that is commanding huge advertising rates. And so I think that the pressure from ABC is also the fact that, as Rand was pointing out, you know, that people are watching things in different ways now. So they're not focused on particular times that everybody watches it. So you come along with this monster show of 3 hours and you're expecting people to pull away from their social media or at least, you know, do other things kind of thing. So it's diffused its power and definitely I think it's changed the landscape. And I can't see it really changing back. And you're seeing a show that is morphing into different forms, trying to find the new way.
And ABC signed on for 10 years, I think.
Yes, that's right.
An enormous amount of money. Anyone who would make a decision like that, 10 years is forever in terms of how media changes.
They would never do that.
But I think, too, if you think about how we measure, we also have to think about how we measure what success is in this time of multiple streams. Because before, you didn't have a choice. You watched it at that time or you did not watch it, right?
Right.
But you can either stream it later. You can DVR it. And then where a lot of things happen now, you know, to go to your point about social media, is on social media. So really, so sometimes your ratings number isn't what it used to be, and nobody's getting those ratings anymore, and that's fine. We just have to figure out a new metric and a new measurement. But there are a lot of things that exist even beyond that on social media. You know, how many people have seen a GIF of this particular moment, or how many times has this thing been trending? So even if, you know, as much as we know that there's a change in viewership and how people view, they're going to be trending. I mean, they're going to be trending. Just the red carpet, stuff already, ready right there. People sit and they, you know, I'm not going to lie, I may be doing the same thing. You know, you get your popcorn, you get your food, you have your wine, and you look at people's outfits, and then what do? You go on social media. You're like, why is she wearing that? Why is he not wearing that? So there are metrics. It's just, we just have to adjust what our frame is. And so if 20 million people watch it live, but X amount of people stream it for a certain amount of time, and Y amount of people tweet about it, there's still a lot of significant numbers there, and it's still to an advantage to continue to promote this brand.
And the interesting wrinkle around that is that that is incredibly important to the film industry and the producers, but probably less important to ABC in terms of selling their advertising.
Correct.
Because they will already have done that at a certain level. And
right.
But the film, the significance of the Academy Awards show to the film industry players, all of them, has actually undiminished in that right. scenario.
Well, and I would also argue if ABC is really smart, they will get their social media team and they will figure out how to get it to their advantage.
I wonder if they're going to, we'll see in the next few years, this whole format change to like a short form live stream kind of bites of content instead of making people sit for 3 hours. Because, I mean, I don't feel like I have the longevity to sit in front of my television and listen to 3 hours mostly of commercials at that point, versus if it's more interactive and you're influencing on social media, I think that we might see that shift happen.
You know, you guys are really making me think about stuff, which I have to confess I hadn't really thought about at all, which because it goes back to that question of the host. I always think that the host is kind of a placeholder for us to a certain degree. You know, it's usually not somebody who's a huge movie star. You know, it's a comedian, it's a talk show host, it's somebody like that. And you know, they know these people, but not that well. And they don't feel any particular obligation to be completely reverent about this whole process. Of course, that's carried to a real extreme on the Golden Globes, where, God bless him, Ricky Gervais, you know, goes out on stage, beer in hand, and just begins insulting everybody in the audience, which is also fine with me. But I'm thinking, because of what you guys are saying, that maybe we're the hosts now a little bit. You know, the person who, we don't need somebody to, you know, Jon Stewart to get up there and make fun of all this stuff because of what you guys are saying.
The funniest
right?
tweet,
right.
just the funniest.
Right.
And you also
reaction.
Don't have to sit there. That's the other thing, too. You don't really have to. Even if I'm watching it live, I can hit pause or a commercial can come on and I can, you know, go do something else. So the way we just have more ways in which we can consume it.
And that's that very fragmentation is what the advertisers are terrified
right.
of. Because it enables you to really zigzag around everything.
Right.
And
the
attention span is also a factor when you're talking about 30-second commercials, too.
But I was also,
and so it's an ongoing departure from that model.
Right. Well, you'll notice that in sports, for instance, they've started doing this split-screen thing where the action continues on the left while the advertisement is on the right. And that's a way of preventing you from fast-forwarding through the advertisements. Maybe for those abject categories like cinematography that they don't want to cover live, they'll end up doing the split screen and they'll run these presentations simultaneously in twin panels with the advertisements, which will be terrible.
Or the host will just be a can of Red Bull. All right. We've got to take a really quick break so we'll have time to talk about the actual movies, which we haven't done yet. Coming out of this segment, you're listening to Jennifer Hudson singing I'll Fight from the motion picture RBG.
When your faith is slow and you got no strength left, when you think you've gone as far as you can get, and you're too worn down to take another step, oh, I will take up the struggle. Oh, I know it's a fight. So
I'm ready for the Russian ambassador.
Who did your makeup?
We went for something dramatic. Do you like it?
You look like a badger.
Oh. Are you going to cry? Really?
Well, what do you think you look like?
Badger.
Do you really think you can meet the Russian delegation looking like that?
No.
I will manage it. Go back to your rooms.
Thank you.
Did you just look at me? Did you? Look at me! Look at me! How dare you! Close your eyes!
So that's a clip from The Favourite, one of the Best Picture nominees this year. You're hearing Olivia Colman, who's sort of in the process of taking over the world right now, but in this she plays Queen Anne. Or just the world of Queens, maybe. And Rachel Weisz as Lady Sarah. I guess what I'd like to do is give each of you a chance to maybe make a case for any particular movie that's either up as Best Picture or maybe another coveted category. And Rebecca Castellani, I'll start over here with you. Are you rooting for? I guess you're also allowed to say that you're rooting even harder against some meretricious movie. But I mean, is anything going to matter to you a lot on Sunday night?
I really do care about this film a lot. I don't necessarily want it to win Best Picture. I really do hope Olivia Colman takes Best Actress. I thought she was just absolutely fantastic. And I think that either Rachel Weisz or Emma Stone are deserving of the Supporting Actress nominee. I wish all three of them could be recognized. They really just were this holy trinity of backbiting and manipulation. And it was just a lovely, tragicomic movie. You know, it demonstrates that there's this huge international conflict going on, but really it's this domestic warfare that the film is mostly concerned with. And I think it's a funny movie, it's poignant, and the acting was just stellar. So I really hope that the actresses are recognized. I'm not necessarily – it's not my pick for Best Picture.
What is your pick for Best Picture?
Roma.
All right. I think we're going to be hearing a lot of that. But so, Rand, she may have just stepped on your –
I have two films that I favor, and that's Roma and Black Klansman. And I have two films which, if either of them wins, I'll be screaming, and that is Vice and Green Book. And we can talk about the reasons why. But I like Favorite a lot. To me, Favorite is the only one of the eight films where a lot of the times I really wasn't sure what I was watching. I mean, most of these films in different ways, the director, the makers of the film, they sort of say, here's what our film is going to be, here's what we're going to do for you, and then they do it, and they do it very capably. But with The Lobster, as with Lanthimos's prior film, I mean, The Lobster is his prior film, with The Favorite, as with the same director's prior film, The Lobster, half the time you're thinking, well, is this absurdism? Yes. Is it some sort of farce or travesty? It's actually also quite moving. The Lobster, you'll recall, was about a dystopian future where people who were single were given a month, I think, or maybe 60 days to find a mate. And if they don't find a mate, they then have to transmogrify into an animal of their choosing. And you begin to realize that all these animals hanging around the background of the resort are former humans. In the same way with The Favorite, there's that scene where suddenly all the lords are like throwing, you know, blood oranges at this naked guy. And there are scenes where you have no idea what you're watching or why, but there's a virtue in that. And I like this film because a lot of times, you know, it's the one film where I feel I'm in the presence of a sensibility that's deeply strange and deeply interesting that makes me want to watch more. That said, my favorite film is Roma. Roma is a film that's really calculated to please a viewer like me. It's sort of a combination of Italian neorealism. It has a sort of Vittorio De Sica thing with a kind of late 19th century Dreiser and Crane or perhaps Victorian social novelist concern for social class, plus this lavish Proustian recapture of Cuarón's own childhood in Mexico City. It's beautifully shot. His films always are. What's interesting is previously he used the great cinematographer Emmanuel Lubezki, who was not available for this film. And guess what? The cinematography done by Cuarón himself is just as good as it was in his prior films. The film, the last thing I'll say about it is, you know, there are some people, I heard a critic on the air saying he found the film really boring. There's been a lot of noise about this film, but it is fundamentally a quiet, slow, and meditative film. And you have to sort of gear down to get into this sort of luxuriantly poetic mode of the film. It begins with that scene of waves splashing over this checkerboard pattern of tiles, and it goes on for a long time. Only gradually do you begin to realize it's someone washing a floor. Mm-hmm. It's a very poetic vision. We see the shadow of a plane reflected in the water passing through the mirror. This one image prefigures several important themes of the movie, including hard labor by the main character, who's a maid, including international travel by the small class that can afford it, and waves on a beach, which figure in our climactic scene in the movie. That compaction of images in that one extended visual moment is exactly the poetic mode that this film proceeds in. That's why I think it will be the film of lasting achievement from this whole bunch.
All right. How about you, Vivian? Do you have something that you're in? Actually, the term that you've used in the past is a film that blew up my skirts.
Yes.
So did anything blow your skirts up or blew up, however that works?
And I'm actually going to kind of go the route that everybody else has, and I'm actually going to name two, also because they've already been named. Mm. But the one pick that I'm going to say I know is not going to win. Mm. And it's nominated, but still, I'm going to say Black Panther, and not just and the reason I say that is for a couple of things. One, it should not have taken 40 years for this film, you know, yes. And I say that because I'm in my 40s now, and it should not have taken me 40 years for this kind of film to have been made. I think that it's a perfect culmination of, I would say, of kind of the it's a truly like kind of pan-African film in the sense of you have African-Americans, you have British Africans, you have, you know, it's just this conglomeration. But I also know that the Academy is not really big on Marvel movies. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of judgment for movies that are not dramas. And so we already know that it's not going to win. I know it's not, and it's fine that it doesn't, but I just want to see Danai Gurira in a pretty dress. That's all I want.
Give the people what they want.
Danai Gurira in a pretty dress. But I do know what most likely will win, and I would love for it to win as well, would be Roma. I think Yuritsa Aparicio did an amazing job. And I agree that a lot of people feel like it's slow, it's boring. It's actually not, and it's, I think that the quiet performances are sometimes for a lot of people hard to understand because it feels like, well, anybody could have done that. All she says is one line here or does a look here. And I think that the depth that she brought to that character really deserves a lot of attention. So just I would say Roma.
Just to add on to that, I find that I really struggle to focus entirely on a movie unless I'm in a movie theater. So I started to attend to Roma, which is a Netflix release, thinking like, oh, man, I'm going to struggle through this. I'm going to be on my phone. It's millennial ADD at its worst. And I was transfixed. It put me in a trance. And at the end, I wasn't really sure.
And it's
sure.
So visually beautiful. Yeah. Like, you could watch it. The sound, like, even if there's no sound and you're just looking at it, you're just, the whole time, your eyes are just like, what
it's
am I
seeing?
It's kind of dreamy. Yes. Like,
all right. So this is the moment. I want to come back to Black Panther at a certain point, but this is the moment to bring James in because obviously Roma also has a fairly complicated delivery history, which is, in fact, is being pointed out to me by Jonathan McPants. Roma is actually reporting zero box office grosses. I mean, they did in fact release the movie to theaters for a week or so. You could have seen it at CineStudio if you timed it right, but they didn't even bother to record or report their box office grosses. That's how little Netflix cares about that aspect of the movie. So I don't. James, you have the floor to say whatever you want to say about Roma or whatever else.
Well, we actually showed it in the format that Alfonso Cuarón originally intended, which was he used a new camera, but from Arriflex, called Alexa 65, which has a chip which basically mimics the old 70mm format and produces an absolutely lustrous digital image I didn't think was even possible. And it's such an irony, really, that when we showed it in 70mm on physical film, I mean, it had a sort of tactile quality to it that was absolutely riveting. It was a reminder of what physical film can really do. And this was from a digital origination, which was really something extraordinary. But here is a film he couldn't get any distributor interested in this film. Yep. So the only people he went to finally are people who are anti-theater, who don't want to show films in theaters because they have lots of money. And so he ends up with a situation where he's made this film that is made for seeing in the dark, made for seeing with a concentrated mm-hmm. audience paying attention to it. And it ends up in a streaming situation where it's very hard to appreciate what that film is about. And if you sat with an audience watching it in 70 millimeter, you knew this was something very special, something unique. This was a great filmmaker who understood the magnitude of image and who understood how you could use magnitude of image and not necessarily have it filled with action, that it actually could be something you contemplated and you saw the background, you saw the plane in the background, you saw the action taking place that wasn't really explained. And I, to me, it was just such a bittersweet thing that here we were with a company that finally they, you know, when their arms were twisted, they allowed it to be released in the few theaters. They didn't report the grosses. We had a great turnout, and I think a lot of theaters that did show it had a great turnout. But to me, it's a real dilemma about cinema, about where it stands now, and about this realization that is starting to come, how strong it will be, is a rediscovery of the idea of being in the dark to see something magnificent like that that is not necessarily an action movie. And that is something that the cinema as an art badly needs right now. And it's interesting, too, to compare, actually, I think that Roma should win, definitely. But I also have great respect for The Favorite, because The Favorite, to me, it's almost like a new Molière coming on the scene, you know, L'École des Femmes or something like that, that is totally without any, you know, most people who haven't seen The Lobster, they come and see The Favorite and they say, what the hell's going on here? But Rachel Weisz and Olivia Colman are having and Emma Stone, they're all having a field day with this, which is a free-form farce that is actually taking pot shots at all kinds of stuff in a way that expects the audience to really, like, sit with this and discover something new. And so both of those films, I think, are really thrilling to me, sitting in the theater and actually watching them.
At times, watching The Favorite, I kept thinking of Monty Python, and it seemed like a sort of highbrow Monty Python, you know, Death of Mary, Queen of Scots. Is she dead yet? Oh, I'm Mary, Queen of Scots! Ah, being hit by pillows. But at other moments, the film evokes authentic human
Absolutely.
Pain, and that mix of really absurd farce, a pleasure in malice. And by the way, it's nice. I mean, you can see this as some sort of feminist film in that the male characters are relegated to sort of sexual and political dupes and adjuncts, while all of the enjoyably malicious palace intrigues are being led by
the
women.
And the men are almost dressed as fops.
Yes, they're all foppish.
All with massive two-tone wigs and powdered faces.
The costumes were wonderful.
Yes,
it's an enjoyably wicked, wicked movie.
So I want to come back to Black Panther for a second. First of all, it came out incredibly early in the year, about as early as you can come out and get a Best Picture nomination. And at the time, there was such a groundswell of excitement that there were a lot of people saying, oh, yeah, no, it's going to be the Best Picture or something. I remember watching it at the time, and I'm a big Ryan Coogler fan. He's the director of this. He directed Creed and
also a good movie.
Fruitvale Station and stuff like that. So I think I think you could do a superhero Ryan Coogler directed movie that combined Chadwick Boseman and or Michael B. Jordan and or Dan Aguirre, and you could really do something that could win Best Picture. I kind of don't think this is it. This feels so much like a marshaling of resources, just like getting all of this stuff together at the high production level. But I mean, Rand, I think you said that you don't rule out Black Panther winning.
No, it's I would be happy with that. It's sort of my perhaps third favorite of all the films. But to me, it's inseparable from, among other things, the moment that it came out. When it came out in last January was right about the time that our president was making his desecratory comments about African countries being shitholes. So to have this act of first of all, a billion-dollar film with an African superhero, the kinds of reclamations of African narratives. I mean, the hero is, you know, he's sort of part Mansa Musa, part 007, part Batman. It's a great conflation of, you know, both African historical roles, a sort of dazzling fantasy that reclaims Africa in a way, and the fact that that happens at the moment that we sort of have this brutish villain in the White House, the very white White House, I don't know. I value the film as much for what it represents as I do for the film itself, which I enjoyed, but I'm generally not a fan of Marvel films getting Best Pictures, so I acknowledge a certain bias there.
Yeah, and I think, too, also what happened is that there's always this larger discussion, and we're not, I know we're talking Oscars, but I would also kind of lump Your Crazy Rich Asians in this category. These films had to be made, these films were made finally, which we could argue are certainly long overdue. We shouldn't be 20 years almost into the 21st century, and movies like this are being made that it's still so historical that these casts of entirely people of color are coming out. This should be the standard. So I think that the movie kind of came out and proved that it could be done. It wasn't surprising to a lot of us moviegoers, but it was surprising to a group of people who didn't believe that kind of box office could happen. And so I think that's why when I kind of look at that moment, the way I see what you're saying, Rand, I also look at it in that kind of moment, that it took this long to get to a point where there was a level of comfort and that the road had to be paved and so many things had to happen in order for this kind of a film to be made. Because remember, Wesley Snipes wanted to make Black Panther in the 90s, and that was right after Blade, and he couldn't get it made, and he gave up because at a certain point he became too old to play the character.
This is a franchise that's led by five white Chrises and has been for the last 10 years, and to see the success of this film and to see a cast that wasn't just a bunch of dudes in tight suits running around, white guys, and actually have a diverse cast and a lot of really strong women in the cast. And we don't still have a female-led Marvel movie. I mean, the fact that we're...
March? Next month?
Is that...
Yeah. Yeah. Next month. Next
Black,
month.
Black, oh, Captain Marvel.
Next,
right.
Yeah, next month.
I think it's been a huge stride for Marvel, and I hope they don't
Although
go
I would
backwards.
Argue we already have a female-led, no offense to T'Challa, but...
Oh,
you know,
well, yes.
All right. So, we can't really restructure the government of Wakanda right here, though. We don't have too much time before we need to go to a break, but I'm also wondering whether you have kind of little hidden darlings, you know, either movies that are not nominated or movies that are, I mean, we haven't talked about documentaries at all or anything like that. And James, you see an awful lot of movies. Is there a particular movie that's either part of this conversation or not part of this conversation that you want to mention?
Well, there are two. Cold War is one,
yeah.
The Polish film, which I think is a minor masterpiece in terms of its aesthetics, but also its content. It's extraordinary. And also, If Beale Street Could Talk, which is a remarkable piece of filmmaking that clearly the people, when people were looking to publicize it, you know, they don't know what to do about it. There's so much lack of logic here. I mean, you look at Black
Tell
Panther, for example, that the fact is that for the past 40 years, black audiences have been a huge, significant part of American movie going, that the people of color have continued to attend movies, a wide range of movies in large numbers. And to think that these producers would think, well,
yeah, it feels risky.
Let's put a black Panther movie. We're scared.
Are people going to see it?
Yeah, and I think that if Beale Street Could Talk, I could sort of, you know, I could almost write down the conversations. You know, they say, oh, James Baldwin, he's so difficult and so fractious. You know, people are not going to sit through this story. Oh, does it have a happy ending? You know, it's like. Everything about it, but it's an intricate movie about in every way that deals with the characters in such an extraordinarily revealing way, and it's a very moving film. So I think of that as a very special film. I don't have any illusions about it really being paid attention to at the Academy Awards, but
except for Regina Hall.
Except
I
yes,
hope.
Regina
that's
King.
That's right.
Regina
yes.
King, yes, sorry.
Regina Hall, yes, I agree. But just going back to Black Panther, I agree. With Rand, that I wouldn't be disappointed if it did win a major award, because I do think that that is something that is generally discounted because it was such a huge success. Mm-hmm. The industry people tend to think, oh, we don't have to do anything more about that. It sold itself, you know, and yet it does have this incredibly important cultural significance. And if you sat in an audience watching Black Panther, you knew what that was instantly.
I also objectively think it was one of the best Marvel movies ever.
That
I think that they just
yes,
have weak writing and weak storylines a lot of the times, and this was a genuinely good movie.
Yeah.
Although Logan is the best Marvel movie ever, I think.
Put a pitch in, maybe a predictive pitch, for a surprise, somewhat semi-surprise. I mean, everyone thinks thinks Alfonso Cuarón, and by the way, I think the best prior film of his is a great film called Children of Men.
Oh, my God, that's such a good movie.
A really interesting and scary dystopian futurist film. But I'm not going to be surprised if Spike Lee wins Best Director. He's never won that before. He won sort of, you know, the Lifetime Award. But if you look at the entire body of his extremely various, provocative, interesting, up and down work, you know, there are really very few other American film directors of his generation who can match that. And I think Black Klansman is a very interesting film. It's a sort of one of these everything but the kitchen sink films. It is like 12 different. It's bromance. It's cop story. It's buddy film. It's a critical take on the D.W. Griffith's film Birth of a Nation. It's sort of everything, but it's got this searing ending that invokes Charlottesville. So there's a documentary political, but unlike, for instance, in my view, Vice, which also is a film that mixes up all sorts of things and to my mind ends up being completely incoherent, Spike takes all these different elements and brings it together in something that I think of as a brilliant kind of seminar. I like the film a lot. I'd be totally happy if that wins. The other film I want to plug, it's in the foreign language category. It's probably not going to win, but it's called Shoplifters, and it's from a great Japanese director, Hirokazu Koreeda, who's in his late 50s, and he has done film after film that are of sort of quietly poignant human, mostly family dramas with interesting touches of comedy. And his current film, Shoplifters, is about a sort of jerry-built family of outcasts who are barely making it on the fringes of Japanese society, and they make it partly by shoplifting, and the old man teaches the little adopted boy, you know, the tricks of the trade. And any film, just go look at Koreeda's movies, and they are all done with this sort of signature sensitivity and sympathy.
So we're going to go to a break, but I want to tell a quick story here that will, I think, probably make James have a stroke or something, because it's exactly the kind of thing that he's been talking about all along. So Rand has been very excited about this Japanese movie. And so I get an email from a publicist pointing out this movie and pointing out that it's now been released to the DVD home entertainment market so people can see it. And even saying to me, you know, if you'd like to get a copy to screen before the Oscars, I'd be happy to send you one. I get that email 3 hours ago. think about that. Think about that. That's how that particular publicist is doing his job right now, is sending me an email about a movie that is either going to win or not win Best Foreign Film on Sunday night. All right. So why don't we quickly take a break so we'll have time to endorse things, including maybe any other movies you didn't get to talk about. And we'll come back.
You, buddy, there's a faster gun coming over yonder. When tomorrow comes, let me tell you, buddy, and it won't be long till you find yourself singing your last cowboy song.
We had a similar problem today in the sense that we couldn't agree on a host for these announcements, so we're asking people to just step up and share the duty.
Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants and Kyone Wolf.
Amanda Fish is off in the deep end, far from the shallows now.
The part of Bill Curry was played by Whoopi Goldberg.
I don't think I'm supposed to be in this segment, but did somebody eat the stewed cabbage I left in the break room?
We may be back live on Monday, depending on how Colin's feeling.
It's just that I was really looking forward to eat the stewed cabbage.
Now, back to the nose. Hey, why didn't I get a longer line?
All right. So that's many members of the staff of this and other shows helping out with the announcements. So in studio with me, Rebecca Castellani from We Save Music, Rand Richards Cooper, a writer in many different ways, including a film critic for Commonweal magazine, James Hanley, co-founder of Sydney Studio at Trinity College, where you should just go and see a lot of the movies that we talk about, and the queen of our Oscar show at all times, and I think some kind of nobility in Wakanda. I don't know. I actually have a title there.
She can't tell everybody.
All right. Okay. Vivian Nabetta from the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center. So, we usually do sort of recommendations, endorsements here. I'm kind of opening this up to a pretty free-form approach. You could do something Oscar-related or not. Rebecca, what have you got?
So last night I watched one of the documentary shorts, Period, End of Sentence.
Another
Netflix one. So you can get that one ASAP. But basically it's about this amazing organization called the PAD Project that's helping bring affordable, biodegradable, locally sourced materials to this group outside of Delhi that are trying to make pads more accessible to young Indian women, because usually once they start their menstruation, they are unable to continue school. So it's really enabling these women to accelerate and grow. So go ahead, check that out. It's the padproject.org. Really interesting. If you care to donate, they would love that. And my other endorsement is Tiger Belly in Granby is a delicious place for ramen. So if you're interested in some yummy ramen, check out Tiger Belly in Granby.
You could maybe somewhere or other package that up with one of the
If you're on your period and you really need a good that's where you go.
I wasn't thinking of that kind of packaging. I was thinking about Rand and his Japanese movies.
Well,
but anyway, go
that
ahead.
That works too.
Take it, Rand.
So one film that didn't get a lot of love this year at the Oscars is Paul Schrader's film First Reformed, about the toils of a country parson, contemporary setting in New England or New York State. It's played by Ethan Hawke. Schrader, you'll recall, wrote Taxi Driver, Raging Bull. He's directed a number of movies of his own, including American Gigolo. He constantly or intermittently disses the Academy, so they never give him anything. And this film, he was a student. Schrader published a book about Robert Bresson and Carl Dreyer, and his film very much pays tribute to them and also to Ingmar Bergman. It's a terrific film about a late middle-aged person in a deep spiritual crisis. It's austere. It's anything but a feel-good movie, but it's a terrific movie and should have done better at the Oscars. Locally, I'm going to recommend every third Tuesday evening of the month in New Haven at the Institute Library, which is a small guild library on Chapel Street that has existed for over 100 years. There's a series called Listen Up or Listen Here, where they read short stories out loud, two short stories every evening, and then discuss them. And there's tea and cookies, and it's very lovely and challenging and fun. It's like sort of going back, you know, for a seminar. Two other things. If you're in New Haven and you want to supplement that with a meal, I would recommend the two restaurants that are not costly at all. They're a lot of fun. An Italian place called Olives and Oil, and a funky, cool Indian sort of pseudo-neo-Indian place called House of Naan. That's great. The last thing I want to recommend, because Connecticut's own Peter Tork died yesterday. He was one of the monkeys, and
we're going to have to wrap this up just so they'll have any time at all.
Okay, go watch Your Auntie Griselda, Peter Tork singing.
All right. James, what have you got?
Well, actually, it's sort of cinema and theater combined, but it isn't related to the movie industry. I just wanted to give a shout out to Rutger Bregman, the Dutch historian who lectured the rich people at Davos a couple of months ago. And they wanted to talk about how philanthropic they were, and he wanted to talk about taxes. Well, there's an extremely entertaining video that he made of his interview by Tucker Carlson, which ended up in an explosion of obscenity from Mr. Carlson. And it's on, if you check out the Guardian newspaper, and do a search on Rutger Bregman, you'll find that video. It's just such a pleasure to see somebody actually talk about what taxes do and exactly what hypocrisy means when rich people say that, well, they'll take care of things, but no, we're not going to pay taxes.
Well, great recommendation. All right. I just want to really say, First Reformed is a great movie, and I'm not going to spoil it or anything, but the ending is just unbelievably bad. All right. So, and I like Paul Schrader. All right. Vivian Nebeta, what have you got?
All right. I will make my endorsement relatively quick. So if you would like a little bit of Wakanda in Hartford, I would encourage you to take the Stowe Center. We've just launched a new tour called the Black Experience Tour, and it's a collaboration with ourselves, the Amistad Center, and the Connecticut Historical Society. You pay one price. You go to one, two, or three of those locations. Well, two or three of the locations. And you, in our case, we kind of put Stowe to the side a bit, and we push forward a lot of the Black voices and the influences that she had in terms of Uncle Tom's Cabin. And then we also bring it forward because we connect the past and the present. So we're talking a lot on this tour. You'll find out about contemporary Black history as well as what has happened historically in Hartford. So I would highly recommend that. So please visit our website for that. And if we're recommending things to watch, this is not anywhere in the Oscar category, but I would encourage folks, if you have Amazon Prime, to watch the Lorena Bobbitt miniseries on, and everybody, don't laugh. I know somebody there is laughing. Don't laugh. It really is an actual in-depth exploration of what what happened. And a lot of what people thought they knew or thought they understood, especially with time, really has changed the perspective on a lot of things. So,
all right, we're pretty much out of time here. I'll just quickly one recommendation that I'll make because I've been sitting on a couch for 2 weeks. One Oscar-winning movie from the past that should have had a really short shelf life. I mean, social satire doesn't last very long. It has a very short wick. The Movie Network is kind of amazing. I mean, it really shouldn't. I mean, you know, broadcast television has changed so much. Media has changed so much. Society has changed so much. There's ways in which I just watched this movie. I mean, almost could have been made a couple of days ago. It's really incredible. I mean, that just doesn't happen. So anyway, if you feel like taking a trip down memory lane, and obviously Peter Finch and William Holdman and the much, much younger Faye Dunaway, worth the time.